Support comes from Kappa, presenting An Evening with Fran Lebowitz, March 6th at the Southern Theater. The evening will feature an unapologetically opinionated talk moderated by Ann Fisher, audience Q&A, and book signing. Tickets at kappa.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A red wave predicted for the 2022 elections petered out due in large part to the turnout of young voters. The midterm saw the second highest youth voter turnout in nearly three decades. Ruby Bell Booth is elections coordinator for the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University. CIRCLE is a nonprofit organization focused on youth civic engagement in the U.S. Ruby Bell Booth, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, Anne. Thank you so much for having me.
What does your research say, tell you about what drove younger voters to the polls during a 2022 midterm?
One of the main things that it seems got young people really engaged were the issues that matter to them. And this is something we've seen consistently since 2018, which is that issues that are really relevant and salient to young people. In the case of this election, it was abortion and inflation that really turned young people out. But that's one of the main motivators that we see with young people when they're going to the polls. They're thinking about how this election could change some of these issues and impact their daily lives.
They're credited with helping the Democrats to a better than expected showing and fending off the red wave. Do younger, let's talk about how they identify. Did they mean to do that? I guess is one question to ask.
Young people definitely have a tendency to support Democratic candidates, and they're ideologically more liberal. That being said, compared to prior generations, they're a lot less likely to identify with either of the two major political parties. Part of that could be related to a pretty strong lack of trust in both parties. Our recent poll found that only about 30% of young people trusted the Democratic Party, even fewer for the Republican Party. And interestingly, there's about just as many who distrust both, but there's also this big swath of people in the middle who neither trust nor distrust either of these parties. And I think that that group's really interesting when you're thinking about, why young people are turning out. They're not necessarily turning out because of their allegiances to these parties. It really is about what candidate they see as taking action on issues that matter to them and really listening to and speaking to themselves and other young people.
So they're issue forward, not necessarily individual forward. They're not looking at the candidates in and of themselves.
Yeah, I think that may be something that they think about a bit more than parties. I think young people aren't necessarily going to see, oh, there's the party I always vote for, that's who I'm going to vote for. I think that they're sort of weighing how these candidates and the parties and, maybe nonpartisan organizations are talking to them about certain issues and how that's going to sort of impact who they want to support.
We talk a lot about the turnout, the second highest youth voter turnout in nearly three decades. Can you put that in context? Is it really that high of a turnout, or it's just the second highest?
Compared to past midterms, it really is an impressive turnout. Midterms tend to be elections where young people sort of slip even more when it comes to their turnout, and the whole population does, because they don't often get the same media attention as presidential election years. And so already you see that midterms tend to have lower turnout. But since 2018, we have definitely seen an increase in turnout that, especially in midterms, is really impressive. And it does seem to be matched by an increase in other forms of political engagement. And so that's why we're sort of starting to identify this as a trend, is because it's not just a trend in turnout, but we're also seeing a trend in, protesting or getting involved in politics in other ways, that there's an increase in those things as well.
Are there any groups in that Gen Z demographic that's underrepresented at the polls?
There definitely are, and I think it's been different for different elections, but there are distinct barriers that young people face to voting, and some of those barriers are especially felt by certain groups. One of those groups is young people who have less educational experience. There's a lot fewer opportunities to learn about how to vote, to get registered to vote, and to just be engaged in general when you have, when you're not necessarily going to college, don't finish high school, because those are often locuses of civic learning and electoral participation.
Okay, so then does that coincide with maybe a low level of wealth?
Yeah, normally it's not every time, but I think that is sometimes seen as a proxy, is education attainment is connected to sort of socioeconomic status. Yeah.
To what extent, younger voters are also more civic minded. They're not just necessarily voting, right?
Yeah, I think that that's definitely the case. There's voting and political engagement and movement participation often really go hand in hand. But also there's young people who aren't voting who are really interested in these issues, who are engaged in their communities in different ways, but may not be voting at the ballot box for a host of different reasons or because of different barriers.
And we've talked about, and a lot of attention's paid to the midterm elections, which are, they identify as important to them and affecting their day-to-day life. But so is the local school board election and the local township election or whatever it might be. How are they turning out on those?
We don't have a lot of data on those sort of local elections, especially when they're in off years. But I think that when there is a commitment in local communities to really connecting the races that are happening to the issues young people care about, you're likely to see young people turning out in those elections. But there's a lot of local communities where maybe a school board race isn't something that's being talked about in local media, or, you know, if young people aren't hearing maybe their parents talk about these issues, or if they go to college, they may not, in a community and they're voting in that community, they may not be hearing about the local school board issues. So it's not necessarily that young people aren't caring about those elections as much, but there's a lot fewer opportunities to learn about those races and to hear about them within the community, which also it offers an opportunity for growth in across our entire country to think about how we can think about local elections as a place to really grow and develop young people's civic identity and identity as a voter.
How do they, what generation, when you look at the data, does it compare to?
Their voting trends?
And their participation and just their level of interest.
I think that, I'm not sure the exact data off the top of my head, but I think that for the age they are now, I think they are showing a really, it is heightened compared to past generations in some cases. So I don't know the data off the top of my head, but I think that they definitely are sort of showing a newer level of engagement for their age group, because for a long time, this younger age group has just been sort of written off as not involved, and they'll get involved in politics when they get older. And I think that millennials and even more so Gen Z are proving that that may not be the case.
What do your researchers think about the turnout in 2022? What does it mean for the future? Since it kind of surprised people, what does it suggest going forward?
It suggests that young people aren't done turning out and they're not done being engaged members of our democracy. But there's also, as you sort of dig into the data past turnout, there's a lot of indicators that we need to be doing a lot more to support young people's engagement. One of the things we saw heading into the 2022 midterms is that registration among 18 to 19 year olds was way down compared to in 2018. So those are the young people who have registered since the 2020 election. And that number is so far down compared to 2018 indicates that there wasn't as much effort or not enough effort going into ensuring that the newest eligible voters were being brought into the electorate. And that's a pretty big failing on the part of political parties, organizations, schools, all the groups that work to register and get young people ready to vote.
Right. You said earlier that this generation doesn't necessarily identify as intensely with the parties as previous generations have. And I'm wondering what your sense about, do parties even care about that? It looks like they dropped the ball this time around.
Yeah, parties, they definitely still are contacting young people, often not as much as other generations. And they have an opportunity to play a really important role in contacting young people, helping them register to vote, and then making the elections really salient to young people in their lives. We found that 54% of young people were contacted by a political party or a nonpartisan organization heading into the midterms. And that's about half of youth, which just doesn't, a little bit more than half of youth, which doesn't seem like quite enough. And we found that those young people who were contacted were 29 points more likely to vote. So that contact really has a pretty big impact on if young people turn out. So there's a lot of opportunity for these parties to sort of step it up when it comes to young people and make sure that they're getting not just, you know, information about the candidate, but the information they need to actually go cast their ballot and to get registered to vote.
What about becoming a candidate? What about getting into it at the very, you know, at that level? What kind of interest do you see on that score?
There's definitely some interest. I think a big thing that we have found is that not a lot of young people are being asked to run for office. And that ask can actually have a really big impact on if they're going to participate. You also see that the groups who are being asked if they've ever thought about running for office, if they want to run for office, are often whiter, they're often men. And so it leaves out a really big portion of really engaged people. Young women of color are some of the most engaged politically, but they're not getting the same sort of level of support when it comes to running for office. So I think that in the future, we're going to keep seeing more incredible young candidates who are going to, I think, excite a lot of young people. But for now, there's still a lot of opportunity to make sure that a wide diversity of young people are sort of having someone in their lives be like, why don't you do it? What, you could run for office, and think about how to support them.
Right. I was wondering to what extent they're motivated or want to follow the lead of, like, you know, New York Rep Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Ocasio-Cortez or something like that. Do they influence? Does someone like her influence?
I think that they may. I think that these younger candidates really show that you can be a young person and make a really big difference in politics. You can win hard races. And I think that that's definitely something that's really motivating. And the other thing that's really incredible about these young candidates is the role that they play in actually providing civic education to young people. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is a great example. She uses her social media really effectively, not just to post the latest trends and sort of, have fun on the app and provide entertainment for young people, but really to use her position to educate about how our democratic system works. And I think that that's something that is really incredible and inspiring. And I think that a lot of young people are able to really connect with her because she's explaining these really complicated processes to people. And the new congressman, Maxwell Frost, was doing that as well. And, giving an insight into how representatives are picking their offices in the Capitol, which is something that I had never thought about until I saw him talking about it on Twitter. And I learned a lot.
Kind of demystifying it.
Exactly. And I think that that sort of thing really can help young people to see it less as this sort of scary, big institution that they're excluded from, and start to see it as something that they could actually access and strive to be a part of.
There's AOC and then there's Bernie Sanders, an unlikely inspiration, to be ageist, just because of his age. But they glommed onto him, and there was a lot of bitterness back in 2016, 2015. When he did not get the nomination, and disappointed, and it felt like disillusioned a lot of young people.
Yeah, I think that that's definitely true. It can be really hard to obviously see your candidate lose, and I think that the reason young people feel so strongly about some of these candidates is obviously because they believe that they can create change. And when instead candidates may get elected who they don't see as, you know, pushing for the things that they want, it can be really hard to just feel like you're being fought for. And I think that that's really important for young people, is they're not just going to, and this isn't to say that, you know, no particular candidate is doing this necessarily, but they want candidates who are really going to advocate for young people. And when they're going to the ballot box, they're thinking about, if, you know, did the person I elect last election do anything for me, or did they get nothing done? And that's going to be an equation when they're thinking about if their vote matters. And so I think that's definitely an important thing, is that candidates really work with young people and fight on their behalf.
And what does that look like? I mean, does it different than just sending them lit through the mail? Is it, what does it mean? What kind of relationship do they have with the candidates?
There's a lot of opportunities for candidates to actually talk to young people about the issues that matter to them, whether it's, you know, a town hall at a high school, or going to a college campus, or importantly, doing it trying to find ways to connect with young people who aren't in college or aren't, you know, necessarily in these educational institutions. So I think that's one big thing, is to just talk with young people and hear from them about the issues that matter to them. Another thing that I think is really important is to then use that information to speak to young people. And I think part of that is, you know, you see a lot of candidates, and in this election, we saw a lot who wielded social media really effectively to talk to young people, because there's this conception that that's where young people are, is on social media. But I think that there's a lot of opportunities to go beyond social media and not just meet young people there, and actually meet them where they are in the community, talk to them, explain how you're going to fight for them. And then once you get into office, keep that process up, have young advisors, and make sure that you're continuing to listen to and fight for the issues that really matter to young people.
Ruby Bell Booth, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Ruby Bell Booth is Elections Coordinator at the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at Tufts University. We're going to continue our conversation about the youth vote, what younger voters care about, and how their participation could shape the country going forward. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the youth vote, what younger voters care about, and how their participation could shape the country. We already know that the red wave predicted for the 2022 elections petered out due in large part to the turnout of young voters. The midterms saw the second highest youth voter turnout in nearly three decades. Savante Myrick gained the reputation of a rising star in progressive politics when he was elected mayor of Ithaca, New York, at the age of 24. He was the youngest and first Black mayor in Ithaca history. Savante resigned his post last year and now serves as president of the nonprofit pro-democracy organization People for the American Way. Savante Myrick, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So now that you're at the crusty old age of 35 and looking back over that record-breaking term in office in Ithaca, I'm wondering what old Savante Myrick thinks about when he looks back at young Savante Myrick.
That's very funny. It's actually 10 years in City Hall, 10 years as mayor, do serve like dog years. So I'm 35 going on about 75 is how it feels. And this is how in part I knew it was probably time to accept a new challenge, is that I was introducing myself to the mayor of Nashville. And I said, oh, hi, nice to meet you. I'm the mayor of Ithaca. And he goes, oh yeah, Ithaca. Ithaca used to have he's looking right at my face. Ithaca used to have a young mayor. What happened? Did he leave town, or did you have to run against him? And I was like, oh, geez. And I do, you know what? I look at, it was a year ago, actually, today, that I accepted Ben Jealous's offer to come and serve as president of People for the American Way, and to work on issues of defending our democracy. And so I was just looking back at pictures from my very first campaign, and I did think to myself, boy, I would not have voted for that kid. He looked like he was still in college. Who voted for him? But I would, what I would tell him is that that it will not be easy, but it will be worth it. It will be worth it. That you will have a lot of sleepless nights. You will gain 15 pounds, and you will watch your friends, you know, have a very different experience in their 20s and early 30s than you. But it'll be worth every single headache, because because you get to serve the city you love and the people that you love.
Did you feel like your age brought value to the role that you had to play?
I do, for sure. I mean, it's a double-edged sword. You don't have a long Rolodex of people to call to help finance your campaign and to give you advice when you find yourself in the middle of a tricky policy debate. But you don't have, like I didn't, a 401k, you know, that you have been building for years. So, you know, at least you can retire, or you can buy a home, or you can, you know, not even worry about the rent every month, which I did every single month of my 14 years of public service. But you also have this energy and this creativity and a moral authority. And the creativity might be the most important of all, you know, and just a total and admirable in hindsight, right? I look back at that young person and I'm like, wow, he was not afraid of anything. He was picking fights with people that he shouldn't have. He was taking on, I don't know, I'm speaking in the third person now, which is the third person past tense. Sure. He was, he didn't know what he couldn't do. And so he accidentally sometimes pulled off what seemed impossible. And I think we need far more of that. You know, I think obviously a blend would be best of young people with their energy and their creativity and their moral authority and their lack of not just a lack of attachment for the status quo, their very refreshing lack of respect for the status quo. I think if we mixed that with a generation of elders, say in the halls of Congress, we would end up with a better governmental system. The shame of it, though, is that if you look at the folks who run the House, the Senate, and even, yes, the White House, it does not look like a broad cross-section of America. It looks very much like a gerontology.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the youth vote and youth participation in politics and, you know, civics in general. My guest right now is Savanti Myrick. He is president of People for the American Way. He was also the city of Ithaca's youngest mayor when he was elected in 2012. He resigned from that office last year to become president at People for the American Way. We're talking about this youth vote, and I'm interested in hearing from youth today. If you're listening right now, I want to talk about what motivates you to go to the polls. What do you think about when you contemplate ever running for a public office? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You know, it seems like when I think about it, we sort of infantilize young people. We think that they're not ready. We don't put them in a position, especially these days with student loan debt and all the other burdens, you know, the gig economy. You're right about that 401k issue. It's a real thing. They're not very well set up, let alone well prepared, because we don't think we don't think they're ready for some reason.
Yeah. And it's a very human thing. I mean, I took office at 24. I ended up being the longest serving mayor in Ithaca's history. And so I found myself sitting, this is no joke, saying out loud the exact same things that were said to me when I was 20 years old and running for the city council. I would have young people in my office and they wanted to pass a Green New Deal in Ithaca. And I would tell them, well, What you got to understand is I tried something like that back in 2007 and it didn't really work. So we shouldn't try it now. And they're looking at me in the same way that I was looking at my elders who were saying, well, we tried something like that in 1994. And I was like, don't talk to me about 1994. And these kids were like, don't talk to me about 2007. They were in third grade. They don't want to hear it. And I had to put myself back in their shoes and trust the wisdom of these young people, you know, from the mouths of babes, et cetera. And I let them lead me to passing the Green New Deal in Ithaca, which put us on a course to be completely carbon free in all of our buildings in the city of Ithaca by the year 2030. It's going to make us the greenest city in the country. And it's going to do it by funneling opportunities to the most marginalized communities, traditionally marginalized communities. And it's just young people that did that. They grabbed me right by the nose and led me. So I think what I learned too is that the kids are all right. They really are. And when we trust them, when we give them a chance to try things, the same way that I was given a chance at 16, my mentor in high school had to leave town unexpectedly. And he called me and he said, you're going to moderate the school board debate tonight. I was like, what do you mean? And he goes, you're going to do it. And he gave me a microphone through which my voice was amplified. And I could ask the parents of my friends questions about what they were going to do to make our school better. And when he trusted me with that, it gave me the courage to keep going. And when we do this for our young people, I'm telling you, these kids are incredible. They know stuff. They're connected through social media to a world that is so much broader than the one I experienced as a kid, and have so much empathy and understanding of different people. And they're okay. If we give them the reins, we will be okay.
They are also in a lot of pain. Mm. There's a lot of stress out there. How do you think that affects their worldview going forward?
Yeah. Well, I think they have the urgency that we need. You know, like everybody in America knows that gun violence is a horror. And yet the people in charge couldn't be bothered to fix it. They just, I don't know if they're remembering the fight to pass gun legislation in the mid 90s. And then they're like, ooh, the Democrats got wiped out after that. We shouldn't touch that again. Well, these kids, they were born after Columbine, and they've been going through shooter drills their whole life. And they've seen their friends lose their lives of gun violence, and they are sick of it. Maxwell Frost is coming into Congress as the first Gen Z member. And he got involved in politics through March for Our Lives, and he has had enough. When these kids, they've been through so much pain, and they are motivated to make it stop in a way that frankly, our generations have failed to make it stop. Same true of climate change, right? I mean, these numbers that even I learned in elementary school, I said, oh, okay, climate change, really, it's going to make it hard to live in these areas by the year 2040, 2050, huge swaths are going to be unlivable. It's going to be mass migrations and starvation, famine. I still hear United States senators say, well, in my lifetime, nothing's going to happen. Well, this is right. It's not just in these kids' lifetimes. It's in their prime. They're going to be 40 years old in 2050. Right? Their kids are going to be alive in 2120, right? So the future doesn't seem like science fiction. The future seems like it's barreling down, and they bring an appropriate amount of urgency to these painful policy questions. And I think if we gave them the reins, they would lead us to solutions.
Munir in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Munir.
Hi, thanks for having me. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Go ahead.
Great. Hi, so I am what they call a Zillennial. I was born in 96, and so I'm not quite sure where that puts me, but I really appreciate this conversation being had today, because I think there's a wide misunderstanding of just how involved we are as Millennials and Gen Z in civic engagement and in all caring about all of these issues that really affect us. I really appreciated that being brought up, especially regarding these issues that are going to impact our lives and our children's lives. And I feel as though there's wide misrepresentation of young people from political parties on all sides, from advocacy groups, from our system. Our elected leaders in general were underrepresented, and we're not taken seriously when we engage with those systems. And I think we really deserve to be taken seriously and to be heard because we do care. And the last thing I want to say is that, you know, when we do show up to these like young political party groups, most of those members are like in their 40s at the youngest. And so we don't feel like we have a place in those spaces. And when we do show up, we're not very much taken seriously. So I appreciate this conversation being had. And yes, young people do listen to public radio.
Munir, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening.
No problem. Thank you. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
If I could just really double down on that point, politicians today are ignoring young people at their peril, because millennials and Gen Z folks vote at a rate that will astonish older generations. They volunteer at a rate that is astonishing. And as you mentioned, the red wave did not materialize because millennials and Gen Z came out to vote, and they voted quite progressively, more progressively than previous generations have. So if folks haven't gotten the message yet, then they won't be in office much longer. You know, this generation is, they mean it, they're here to stay. My generation became open, and so I thought I was square. It turns out I'm technically what's called a geriatric millennial. Really resented finding that out. But for those of us my age, we were in ninth grade when 9/11 happened. We were opened to the world, our effect in the world, the world's effect on us. And we're just never going to turn back from it. You know, we are not occasional voters. We're not occasional activists. This is our life. We care about this.
Why do you think, what sets this group apart, besides the fact that it's the biggest generation since the boomers?
Yeah, I think the size is a part of it. It's also the first generation that all became connected to each other through social media. We lived through the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. And when we were coming of age, a lot of our brothers, cousins, and friends were being sent off to fight, only to come home, and those of us graduating from college, into a Great Recession that was caused by corporate greed, that was not prevented by the government. And then we watched as, in large part thanks to the youth vote, Barack Obama made history. And then we watched Donald Trump get elected, right? So between 9/11, the wars in the Middle East, the Great Recession, and the upheaval at the highest levels of our government have turned us all into, I should say us all, but turn this generation into extremely active political actors. And I don't think we should underestimate the class effects of the millennials, the largest generation since the boomers, also being the first generation in over 100 years to be worse off than their parents. That we all had to move back in with our parents after college, that we all, even to this point, are not able to buy homes and build wealth, that will motivate and animate our politics for the rest of our lives.
Savante Myrick, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. A real pleasure.
Savante Myrick is president of People for the American Way, and he was also the city of Ithaca's youngest and longest serving mayor when elected in 2012. In 2012, he was elected. He resigned from that to join People for the American Way last year after 10 years in office. We are going to continue our conversation, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Race might be a hot topic right now, but for so many of us, talking about race is nothing new. On the Code Switch podcast from NPR, we go beyond the headlines and we go deep. Listen now.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're looking at the youth vote this hour, the issues they care about, and how their participation could shape the nation. We already know that the red wave predicted for the 2022 elections petered out due in large part to the turnout of young voters. John Della Volpe is the director of polling at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics and author of the 2022 book, Fight: How Gen Z is Channeling Their Fear and Passion to Save America. He is also founder and CEO of Social Sphere. That's a public opinion research and consulting firm. John Della Volpe, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks so much for having me, and it's good to be with you.
You make the case that to understand Gen Z, it's about 70 million Americans born in roughly that 20-year period beginning in the mid-1990s. We have to understand who raised them, who came before them, and who is still present in their lives. And that's kind of true of every generation. But what does it mean in terms of this generation?
I think the perspective I want to offer is that, well, every generation, millennials, Gen X, which is my generation, baby boomers, they all deal with some forms of stress and trauma and chaos. But what I argue in the book, and I think what Svante in the previous segment talked about, is that I'm not sure that there's been any generation in at least 70 years since the greatest generation has dealt with more chaos, more trauma, more quickly. And the key point of this, Anne, is that the series of events have happened before the oldest member of Gen Z has actually had the opportunity to be fully mature. Neuroscience tells us that our brain doesn't fully mature until the age of 25. So it's been incredibly difficult for younger people to be a part of these traumatic events, both in our public life, but also kind of in their personal life. And that includes from the very early stages of their development, not feeling quite secure, whether it's in their homes because of financial insecurity or physically going to school, and then the aftermath since that.
Right. It's hard to imagine. I mean, there's a generation before me that grew up doing the duck and cover because of the bomb. But these kids are now going on 20 years of school drills because of a shooter.
Yes, and a couple of points. And the fear that they carry extends well beyond school. It extends to, I heard this yesterday with my own students at Harvard, concerned about walking home, you know, at night, concerned about going to a mall, you know, it concerns to going to the movie theater. It's something that really doesn't leave them. It was actually in Ohio, and it was actually in Columbus. I remember it quite well when I asked a young member of a focus group or town meeting that I was conducting, student from Ohio State. I said, what do you think people like me, my generation, don't understand? And she said to me, and I quote this in the book, the way in which you think about your taxes, your personal finances, that's the way that we think about living and dying every single day. They walk into a classroom, they walk into the auditorium, and they're immediately thinking about where the exits are, you know, what the plan is in case there's some sort of emergency. That's a weight that I don't know if previous generations dealt with that on the consistent basis as Gen Z has, sadly.
You aren't worried about this generation. You say they are connecting the dots between troubles they face and those who disregarded their issues.
Well, yes, and a couple of things. Unlike the baby boomer generation, you know, obviously seeing Vietnam, seeing ripped apart, political assassinations, that generation, like my generation, also saw America at our best, as did millennials. I think that to me, the difference between a millennial and a Zoomer is the understanding and the presence of 9/11 in their lives. Specifically, not only 9/11, but September 12th and September 13th, when they saw America come together. This is something that this generation has been robbed of. However, as the title, as the book says, rather than withdrawing, rather than fleeing, this group of young Americans, unlike any group in three or four generations, has decided to use all you know, peaceful means possible, you know, to kind of to extend themselves and to fight and to vote and try to change the system that they believe so many elites and older Americans are preventing from basically helping them live their best life.
Why do you think we're lucky enough that they're doing that? Why do you think they're like that?
Well, you know,
why not cut
that's
and
a
run?
Great point, right? Right. Well, because it's funny, like Gen X is essentially kind of, you know, shorthand, right, would be their parents, right? But we see the gap in the way in which they think about politics, Gen X and Gen Z widening over time, you know, where Gen X is turning more and more, you know, to Republicans and more conservative, the opposite for their kids. Yet this generation has this sense of protecting each other that I think is really quite nice, is a sense of empathy. When I talk to young people and I say, why vote? They don't say I'm voting, you know, to often make my life better. They're voting to protect somebody more vulnerable than they are. Right. Which I find, again, very inspiring. And I do think that we talk a lot for good reason about the negative aspects of the interconnected world around social media. But I think that the sense of empathy can also be enhanced by seeing other young people in similar positions struggling in this country, in this community, and around the world that I think might help give some inspiration to young people to go out and try to change the system.
You identify three factors that make this generation of young voters unique, and it starts with Trump coming on the heels of Barack Obama. Was that a specific trauma in and of itself?
Well, it was certainly kind of, I talk about kind of this whiplash, and I think whoever was going to win that 2016 election would be kind of a transformative, you know, president in the lives of this generation, whether it was going to be, you know, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. But what Trump was able to do, and this could be one of his greatest positive legacies, I think, is that he showed to everybody, but to specifically to younger people coming of age, thinking about politics for the first time, the real difference that politics can make. Right. And that was always the most significant predictor of whether or not a young person would vote, is do they see a tangible difference in their participation? Because as your last guest noted, you know, oftentimes there's more young people who volunteer than vote. They need to see that tangible difference. And that's what Donald Trump delivered, you know, literally from the very first day in office. Most, you know, for two thirds of younger people, most of those tangible differences were negative. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, withdrawing from the Paris climate agreement, border walls going up, you know, certain people not being allowed to come to this country based upon where they're from, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that was something, you know what, that young people said, you know, politics does matter. And then, of course, it turned, you know, far more negative pretty quickly, including Charlottesville. And you know, and I talk obviously a lot about the other events that kind of crystallize this generation.
Right. The shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. You know, David Hogg is almost a household name now. He came out of a tragedy like that, and he's still out there.
He is. And I think, you know, again, I've been research and spending time, I talk about myself almost being embedded with younger people between my kids, you know, my community, the students, and the research. So again, been doing this for 20 plus years now, and we have never seen, even after Newtown, had not seen kind of this dramatic double-digit increase in support for stricter gun laws, you know, that we had seen. I think it's more than Parkland. I think it's a combination of Mandalay Bay on October 1st and Parkland, those two events together. You know, I talk in the book, in the time it takes me to order a coffee at Starbucks, you know, a dozen plus families were changed forever. And David Hogg, it's interesting. I write in the book, like his parents and his family chose that particular community and chose that school because of accessibility to journalism, right, into media. So he had always been kind of a news junkie, and he really wanted to tell that story. And he he found that opportunity, because if he didn't take that opportunity that evening to tell the story of what it's literally like to be concerned for your life and to see so many other of his students tragically murdered, that he was afraid that America would forget this, like so many of the other events. And he really challenged all of us, as well as obviously, his classmates, Jackie and ex Gonzalez and so many others. But that was certainly kind of, I said, like two or three of the more of the more significant events. And I don't know if you're going to go here, but we don't know who Greta Thunberg is, I don't think, without Parkland. And what I really found interesting as I was researching for the book is that Greta back in Sweden was cared so much about climate, but she was so frustrated that no one else was really kind of taking it seriously. She had entered essay contests and tried to do a variety of things to organize her fellow students, but it wasn't until she read online that the Parkland students started a school strike. But she says, you know what, let me try the school strike. One thing led to another, and I think she's, along with David and his classmates, some of the most important and inspirational people on the planet.
I think a big difference, this is a digital native generation now. They have a very different relationship with the evening news, quote unquote, a very different relationship with technology. They can use it, they can wield it as, you know, as a powerful weapon. But you do wonder how in touch they are with what's going on a day-to-day basis in the country, because they don't all read the same newspaper at night or watch the same TV show.
No, they don't. And what we found really, and one of the real inspirations for this book is seeing this concern for their own mental health, right? That I couldn't not see when I would just go out there and talk to people, but also that connection about concern about the state of our public affairs that was also, you know, creating anxiety, depression, hopelessness, et cetera. So therefore, more times than not, they're using their phone to actually basically regulate how much news they're getting, because they find it very depressing, especially younger folks, you know, who are still in school or in college or something. So they're not getting, we're collectively not getting, you know, kind of an opportunity to all kind of see and talk about and process the news. You know, we're doing this today at the State of the Union. This is one of those moments, I think, where we've actually seen interest among younger people increase for nights like this. So what we find is two or three, four nights, I think, throughout the year, where younger people will choose to check in, you know, on governments, and then hopefully we can have conversations about what it means thereafter.
You refer to a once in a generation's attitudinal shift about the impact of participating in the political process. That's big.
Yes, and that is. And we can see that in the numbers, right? So this is a one, I've seen now this twice. I saw this pre and post 9/11, where we saw a double digit increase in those survey questions that I mentioned earlier that kind of were predictive of the tangible difference a politics can make, which is connected to increasing levels of participation. Okay, we saw the same thing, not in 16, but in 17 after Donald Trump's first 100 days. Mm-hmm. And to what that means, Anne, is that essentially in 2018, the midterm election, we saw a roughly 50% increase, almost actually higher than that. It was almost a doubling of the number of young people who voted in 2018 relative to 2014. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the average for the last three decades, in midterm elections, sadly, only about one in five baby boomers, Gen Xers, and millennials had participated, somewhere between 15 and 20 points. In 2018, the first midterm election of the Trump presidency, we saw that increase to close to 36 percent. And in 2020, despite the fact that Joe Biden was the, you know, oldest a nominee for president. We saw the highest turnout ever on record, you know, on college campuses and among students, which it was challenging to vote because of COVID. That percentage was close to 60 plus percent, which is tracking all U.S. adults. And we saw similar numbers in the past midterm elections. So again, that is, I think, the kind of the positive, you know, aspects of the Trump presidency. He made politics tangible, meaningful, and now we have an entire generation three times in a row been voting in numbers that no other previous generation at this age had participated in.
John Della Volpe, we are out of time. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
John Della Volpe is the director of polling at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics. He's the author of the 2022 book, Fight, How Gen Z is Channeling Their Fear and Passion to Save America. That's it for now. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.